Welcome back, everybody. It just keeps coming. It's Soft Revolution, the podcast. I'm Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, we are not alone, people. We're not alone. We are joined by the brilliant and wonderful Jennifer Lina, friend of the pod. Jen is an associate professor of arts administration and sociology at Columbia University. She's an author of books like Banding Together. She is a great thinker about culture. She is a great thinker about how the world might change if we embedded culture into our public conversation more often. And she is a dear friend of this podcast. And we thought we would get Jen back because she's A, awesome, and B, American. It's a country to the south, which has several problems. and we wanted to check in with her because she's in New York City. Which is a place that has been going through a lot of ups and downs and a lot of highs and lows, and we missed her. So this week on the pod, we're going to just, all three of us, go through the ever-eternal, never-ending shitstorm that is modern life. Jennifer, how are you?
I am so well and so glad to be back with all of you. Hello, friends.
Thank you for joining us, man.
Return in 2021.
I know. Yeah. You're like someone who appears occasionally on a sitcom and it's everyone's favorite person. Everybody says, why don't they just have that person? Maybe you should have an offshoot. Maybe this is the beginning of the Jennifer Lina show. And then we can be a guest on your show.
Have you ever thought of doing a podcast?
No, it's news to me that I'm good at this. I mean, really, like now is the moment I'm finding out that this is working. So
We get mail about you. We do.
Well, I'll amp it up this time. I'm feeling very frisky today. We've got a lot of nonsense going down here. And, I'm at the tail end of what's called a sabbatical. I have this relief from teaching this year.
Nice.
I've obviously been using it to do a lot of community organizing. I've been sitting in my apartment. But that time is winding down. So my brain is starting to like really want to indulge in some frivolity before I have to go back to my old life.
Okay, well, let's start there. That means you'll be going back to teaching, I'm assuming, in September.
That's right.
What is your understanding of what that will look like for you right now?
So it's a very reasonable question, but we don't have a clear answer yet. So in terms of like policies, I think the expectation is that the college, Columbia in general, and then Teachers College where I work, I think the expectation is that we'll go more or less back to in-class instruction, face-to-face instruction.
Right.
But we have such a huge percentage of our students and some of our faculty who are coming from abroad. And, we really don't have a good solution yet to make sure that they can stay included in the life of our community, even if they're unable to come to the United States. So still a lot of open questions.
Yeah, my wife has been taking graduate work this year. And so she's been TAing online and she's been going to lectures online. And I mean, I'm constantly amazed at her ability to stay good natured about it and to actually get stuff done. But she is like, we've just announced here in British Columbia, Bonnie Henry, the chief medical officer, said you got to return to school. So she has told universities they have to come up with a plan to get people back to school. And the reaction was like euphoric, you know, like not just from Moya, but from her students and from the people that she works with. It's just been really bad. It's been really hard and really bad. And I mean, that's a sad piece of news. But on the other hand, for me, that, as I was saying to Ali last week, there is like a real sense of peacefulness knowing that all these things were inadequate, that Zoom is not a replacement for socializing or for being together, and that none of this technology has filled the gap in our desire to actually just be in a room together and do things with each other. So, you know, what do you mean?
I think it's going to be a medium. I think what we're learning is school is difficult. I'm a professor at George Brown, and I have to teach acting, which is like very difficult over Zoom.
You can't teach acting over Zoom.
Well, you know, you can try. Hey, don't say that. Of course you can. But I will definitely say, I mean, the proof of concept of Zoom has really shown itself. I think domestic air travel is going to decrease exponentially. I think there's going to be a lot of things people are not going to do in person. There's a lot of things people are going to do. See a Starz show, go see a play, go see a musical, you know, go to a bar. But the notion that this will not be a part of our lives is absolutely, utterly wrong. Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I would add to the conversation that hasn't been raised yet is that this is not a good time to evaluate whether or not faculty are good at delivering instruction over Zoom, because it is also the time that faculty are raising their children at home with no assistance, at least in the United States. So none of my colleagues have the opportunity to display the strengths of online instruction because we are barely surviving. I mean, it is not a complaint that I raise very often because there are such grave injustices happening to other folks. And in the scope of things, this is a small issue. But, you know, what university teachers did this year was double their workload at work by continuing to do all of their activity and then learning how to do it in this new modality. And on top of that, assuming responsibility for raising children or for taking care of elderly. And this is literally not a sustainable workload. And yet we're 11, 12, 13 months into it. So I think, like, as much as there is a public thirst for thinking about how to take advantage of these new modalities to make information more accessible and less costly, and all those things are valuable, I hope that we will never forget that there are human beings here who are laboring in order to provide this content. And those people are suffering on a scale that is really hard to explain in, like, a brief snippet.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's so funny how many of the things that are problematic about this moment have to do with chronic underfunding and chronic undersupply of resources. So whether it's childcare or it's education or it's most of all the medical system, you know, these numbers of people that are coming through the medical system right now, they are not, relatively speaking, massive compared to what happened in the early 80s in New York City when AIDS popped up and suddenly there was just like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people dying within days. This is not that massive, but what it is it's massive to a healthcare system that just for decades has not had enough resources and money to go on. So I do feel like the circularity of my conversations makes me feel a bit crazy these days, where, like, to me, everything ends with why the hell don't the rich pay their taxes and why are we all okay with this and why do we expend so much energy and time and argument and division and so much anger and rage arguing about things that could be solved by taxing the rich. It's a real strange mystery how much we worship people's ability to make money and then hold on to it. We really think highly of them. It's quite strange. Listen, let's get to culture, because that's what it says on the tin. Jen, you are a thinker about genre, Jennifer Lena. That's one of the things you think about. It's French for bands. And speaking of bands, Adam Levine, of one of the great art rock bands of the last 50 years, Maroon 5, which for some reason has seven people in it. Ask Adam Levine. Don't come to me with your complaints about numbers. Adam Levine said recently in an interview that there are no bands anymore. Now, Adam Levine is a guy, you know, he could say for the first time the theory of relativity and everybody would just take him down on Twitter because there's something about the guy that just makes you want to be mean to him. But immediately everybody jumped on him and said, oh, what an idiot Adam Levine is. Of course there's bands. Well, guess what? Adam Levine is correct. There are very, very, very much fewer bands. And in fact, the Guardian newspaper this week got on board with Adam and agreed with him and wrote this article called Why Bands Are Disappearing, quote, Young People Aren't Excited by Them. And it talks to A&R people and it talks to musicians and looks at the number of bands in the charts right now compared to the number of bands years ago. And it's quite extraordinary. Now, I think the reasons for that are obvious, right? Technology, people spend more time alone in their bedroom. You can make music on your own.
Yeah, you don't need it as much as you used to.
Big part of it. Yeah. It's very expensive to start bands. The equipment is very expensive. You need space to do it in. You need a place to make noise. But most of all, you need a generational commitment to getting together in a room and not living your life online. And that doesn't exist right now. I'm sad about it as a musician, as a band member, because I think, not musically speaking, I think there's just as much good music now as there ever has been, and there always is. If you look hard enough, there's always great music out there. But as a person that experienced so much joy and love and unity and safety within the confines of a band, it concerns me that not just bands, but all these kinds of group activities are disappearing. What do you think bands disappearing from the landscape, whether it's, you know, no matter what the genre, whether it's, you know, the OJs or De La Soul or Sex Pistols or the Smiths, what do you think it's doing to music, and does it make you feel concerned as a lover of music?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. So first I would say, like, the you haven't defined band, and I think that definition is loose on purpose in your argument, but probably if I were going to push on this, I would start there and say, like, okay, so what are the limits of it? Like, how welcoming is the concept of band to, you know, certain kinds of traditional vocal music or to electronic music? Like, do those people even have a shot at being included within this world that you're envisioning? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. But even if we had settled on a kind of definition of a band, what does a band do? Like, I think we can think about it in two ways, right? The audience experience and then the creator's experience. And those things blur. I know, you know, obviously musicians are in audiences, but if you are coming up as a musician, the space that bands and other kinds of collective creation spaces give you, I mean, these are contexts in which you get pushback, you learn how to negotiate conflict with other people, you have opportunities to witness other kinds of creative processes that you can then consider whether you want to adopt the elements that you like in your own process. So there's so much kind of learning, both of the technical skills of creation and then the soft skills that surround that and make people able to work in groups. And then on the consumer side, I mean, we learn a lot of the same things by seeing a bill that has not only the act you went to see, but the others that were booked alongside them. You get exposure to stuff that you don't otherwise. And same thing in those rooms, you get exposure to people that you don't otherwise run into. So all of that, like, you know, even if I were to make it a really dark example, I would say if you are a woman going into an entertainment space, these are places where you learn how to protect yourself in public space, where you learn how to protect one another. I mean, as much as we want to say women shouldn't have to do that, we live in a world in which they do, and these spaces help us to practice all of that stuff. So there may be analogs in online spaces, but that's what immediately comes to mind.
The other thing I also think about is that, you know, yeah, we don't have bands, but if you look at a liner note of every individual artist when it's just a single person, it is full of collaboration and people. Yeah. And the thing you will see is that it is a repeated set of the same people over and over and over again. So there is that kind of sense still happening. The thing that worries me, though, and it is because of streaming, you don't get those liner notes anymore. You don't get any of that information. You get no sense of what type of collaboration is going on. And it's this thing that I really hate, that people start to think that art is done in a vacuum and it's this singular process. And nothing good, nothing great is done by one person. It is an utter and complete, it's a practice of collaboration. So yeah, I think hey, BTS is still doing what they do. They're huge. So don't say the band is dead. It's just being usurped by one band. It's just one band taking over the world.
They're a group.
They're a group.
More than a band. Do you know what I mean?
What's a band and what's a group? What's the difference?
Well, coming back to what Jen was saying about classification, I guess the difference is that I agree totally, Allie. There are groups. Like, Billie Eilish is not just Billie Eilish. She's her brother, and she's the people they work with who are engineers. And there's a crew there, right? And they're making those records. But I don't know why we don't enforce what I assume is in all contracts, namely I get credit for things and that credit needs to be available to the people consuming it. I'm sure that's in a contract somewhere, but no one seems to be enforcing it with Spotify. But B, like, a band is a group of people, I think, who write music together and who occupy an aesthetic place together that they choose upon. It's a gang, for lack of a better word. And in the same sense that a gang adopts clothing and adopts lingo and inside jokes and ways of being, bands do that too. And it is a beautiful feeling to be in a gang. It's not nice if the gang ends you in jail or dead, but the gang mentality, we find it in team sports, we find it in book clubs, we find it in all kinds of ways, right? That make us feel like we found our people and we found our aesthetic crew. And for me, that's really what it was. What it was is like a band was a place for someone who wasn't cool and didn't feel cool to go find someone who was like, hey, you're cool. Let's start a band together. And to me, that is a great thing when you're a young person to find that group of people. And a band is just another way of making that happen. So it's just one less way of young people having a sense of identity, I guess. And that's what makes me sad about it.
Torque, let me ask you a question. If Adam Levine, it's 2021 and Adam Levine has, you know, those pearly eyes and that falsetto, and he's like, I want
to...
All those tats. And,
so many
and he
tattoos.
Said to himself, I want to start a career as a musician, as a singer.
Yeah.
Do you think he'd get a band, or you think he would just be a solo artist?
And he would not get a band.
He would be just Adam Levine.
I mean, I don't know Adam Levine, so I don't know. Maybe he's a band guy, but I know that the label would not want him to have a band. I mean, this is the other thing, and the Guardian article goes into this, is like bands are problematic for labels. You're dealing with five people instead of one person. You're spending money when you go on tour, you're spending tons more money. I mean, my band, you know, we are really like sort of one of those old Italian restaurants in New York City. You can't believe it's still open and the waiters still wear bow ties and stuff. And you're like, how are they doing this? How is this chicken marsala still this good? You know, we're too big to exist in a way, just literally as a group of people. We're six people with a crew. And what kind of financial sense does that make when you can sell the same room out with you and a turntable, right? So it's economically, bands are very cumbersome and not efficient. And that is another reason why I think they're disappearing. But, you know, as at the end of every show we play, I always say to the audience, start a band with your friends. And I really mean it, you know, because it is so joyful to get together in a room with people and make lots of noise and hang out and have a beer and talk and try to create something together. It's a beautiful thing to do. So even if you're not doing it for a living, I hope that amateur bands, you know, neighborhood bands grow, because it is a great way to spend time with people you love, you know.
I have to share two things. One is that I just finished last week reading the Chris Franz autobiography from Talking
nice.
Heads, and
yeah.
There is a good, I mean, so he's upset about a lot of things, and it's not terribly well written. My apologies, but this is not your strength, my dear.
Musicians' memoirs never are. They just aren't.
Not a great read, but
no.
it actually is an excellent example of the fact that being in a band can both involve these frustrations of not getting proper acknowledgement for your contribution and can provide an unparalleled environment for experimentation and exploration and life satisfaction.
Yeah.
The second thing I wanted to say is that I was rereading one of my colleagues' work recently. She studies country music, and the study that she's done is really demonstrates the ways in which that industry has organized itself to eliminate the band from anything other than performance royalties. And the system that they have of songwriting and feeding songs to artists without those songwriters necessarily being a part of what the audience is consuming, like who the artist really is here. This is longstanding practice in that genre, and much the same could be said about the way in which jazz performance is organized, where, you know, the majority of the backing band gets very little of the revenue and very little of the public credit. Mm. So I wonder if we can think about this heterogeneity across fields, that rock music has actually managed to retain the band structure, as you're describing it, much longer than other worlds, and maybe is... And this is a big maybe is more equitable as a result of that. Maybe there is a better labor relation within the band structure vis-a-vis capitalism than there is in these other worlds.
I have an ignorant question. Is everybody in Maroon 5 getting the same amount of money? No.
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 No. The answer to that is no.
So what's the journey there? Is that from the beginning? Like, how does this work? Like, how does this work?
It's from the beginning. With Stars, the reason that Stars are still together after 21 years, the exact same people, is because at the beginning we said we are splitting everything equally, every decision, every penny, everything.
Socialist Everybody band, gets a baby, vote. I love it.
We're a democracy. So every t-shirt we make, every record cover decision, every song we put on the album, every artistic decision, every money decision, we go to a vote. We decide. And a lot of the time, And it's not always like, okay, it's 3-2, we win, or 4-2, we win. Sometimes it's 3-3, or it's 5 against and 1 in favor, but the 1 in favor is like, this really pisses me off. And the other 5 are like, okay, we'll do it your way. So it's not a strict voting system, but everybody gets their input all the time. And that is unusual, highly unusual in a band. The reason bands break up most of the time is because you have 1 or 2 people who are making all of the publishing money, who write the songs. And so they're making, by a factor sometimes of hundreds, more money than the other people in the band. The other people in the band start to get jealous. They say, hey, my bass line on, you know, that song, you never really gave me writing credit for that, but I wrote that bass line, and why the hell am I not getting that publishing money? And it becomes ugly. So, you know, like anything creative, if you, and I say this in general, like I know people are starting hustles all over the place out there right now. If you're doing it with partners, have the difficult conversation right away. Eat your frogs, you know, right away. Get those frogs in you, because it's not going to get any easier. And with each step of commitment that you make with each other, you're building more ground for misunderstanding, and you're fermenting more ground for ugliness down the road. So, like, that's why bands are hard to keep together. The Beatles, you know, the Beatles broke up not because of Yoko. The Beatles broke up because it was people really struggling for power who had never really talked to each other about what their creativity meant to each other or how to deal with it, you know?
I was going to say it's the same thing in scientific collaboration. One of the things I say all the time is, even though it feels like this gross imposition of paperwork on top of this beautiful little new baby chick of a collaboration that you've just hatched, if you don't do it then, you're going to end up with this hydra that nobody can control. And so I tell all collaborating scientists, you got to make a quasi-contract. Who's responsible for what? Who picks up the slack? How do you compensate them if they're taking on your work because something else comes up for them? Like, how do you make sure that the author order, the credits of your products are pre-negotiated, so you don't have to have that conflict in the middle of trying to get the work done and focusing on the work?
It makes people crazy when money comes into the equation. Speaking of crazy, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like, you know, we've all been losing it for a long time now, but I feel a fresh flavor of losing it lately. And, you know, you and I, Ali, have talked about this a couple of times recently, about this fragmentation, this sense of like narratives fragmenting. And to that, there's an interesting little piece in the New York Times this week called COVID's Partisan Errors, in which it says that research is showing that Republicans, i.e., let's say for the purposes of our international audience, the right-wing people tend to underestimate COVID risks, and left-wing people tend to exaggerate COVID risks. So in other words, research has shown that if you are right-wing, you tend to not understand the importance of mask wearing. You don't respect social distancing as much. You have a tendency to distrust vaccines. If you're left-wing, you have over-concern about things that don't necessarily warrant it, in touching surfaces, for example, or being outside unmasked with people, these kinds of things. We all know where that comes from. We've talked about it a lot. Social media, the internet, is dividing us up into algorithmic segments so they can sell us their version of whatever truth they think will make us buy shit on Amazon. but it's scary. It's scary because we are now moving to this next stage of, even though, and we'll talk about this maybe in a little while, even though these variants seem to be doing what all the scientists said they would do, and it's freaky, and we might see another wave here, we are also dealing with mass vaccination. You know, death rates amongst our elderly are plummeting all over the world. This thing works. These vaccines work. So we're moving into a new stage, and I am really concerned that people's paranoia on the left and people's carelessness on the right is only going to accentuate and not coalesce into some version of what we can agree upon as collective truth. Ali, what are your thoughts as you're going out there and talking to people on the political hustings? What are you hearing from people? Are people as misinformed as they appear to be on the internet?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's, and I don't know really what to do. I actually, you know, I think about it deeply, what we need to do. There needs to be because we're in these echo chambers, there needs to be an authoritative voice. And I think that voice needs to be the leader. And I think for us, it needs to be, there's only one person who could get us out of this. It is our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. I really miss him coming out every single day that he did. And he just would walk out and have a long conversation. And Joe Biden, we spoke about it last week. I mean, Jen, I don't know what you could tell me what you think about this, but I feel like he's trying to bring back the FDR fireside chat where we sit and we're going to have a long conversation, because what we are talking about cannot be told in 280 characters. It can't be told in a 1 minute Instagram video. It can't be told in a TikTok. These are complex things. Because otherwise, what's going to happen? We're all going to just start yelling at each other. The information is crazy. Like today, for instance, they allowed the AstraZeneca vaccine to come to people who are 60 all the way up to 70. And just having a conversation with people who I know to be like, okay, you should go get it. And it's like, yeah, but wait, I heard about this and this, and they said that and this. And it's just a whole layer of just misinformation. They're just misinformed. So what do we do? I kind of feel like I have two thoughts. Number one, the leader, whether it's Joe Biden or Justin Trudeau, has to come out there and talk and let people know what's up. And the other thing, I tweeted about this, and we could compare this to America. I said, look, I wish everybody in Canada read the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the National Post, which is our right-wing paper. It would be equivalent to saying, I wish everyone in America read the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. I wish. But guys, nobody does. In our circle, maybe they do. But we need to start meeting people where they are, understanding them where they are, respecting them where they are, and recognizing that everything that they're doing in the lens that they're looking at is highly rational. And so we need to be able to like have proper conversations with people, because you are right. Like people are just like all over the place.
There is no collective truth.
So Jen, like, how do we do this? How do we get a collective truth again? And I want to ask another question, Jen. I want you to answer this. These vaccines, like when the polio vaccine came out, people were in the street. People were going ham. It was like unbelievable. And I had a thought to myself. I was like, are we ever going to experience a collective victory anymore? Will we as a society ever, as one, listen, there's always going to be some like the 5%, fine. But are we ever going to get a 90% feeling about something anymore? Is that ever going to happen, or has social media and polarization destroyed that?
Yeah. So I'm not sure that we ever had a 90% anything. I think that one of the things that happens when we look back at the past is we really have to like filter it through the lens of white supremacy, where we know that so many communities were not being covered in the news. Their responses to global events So I think that's the immediate hiccup in sort of looking back. But to the question,
End of the World War, end of World War One, World War Two. Is it that wasn't a collective yay? I'm just thinking like a vaccine coming for COVID. I understand there's a lot of systemic things. There's a lot of groups that are wary about it. I get that. But I really thought that the fact that four vaccines in Canada and three vaccines in the US have been approved less than a year. Wow. Is there a moment of wow? Can we have a moment of wow in this world? It's not.
I know. I keep seeing you ask for that on Twitter. And it's not that I think it's the wrong impulse. It's the right impulse. You're not coming from the wrong place at all. But I think that you might be asking too much of us at this moment. I mean, I think that we are, at least I feel so profoundly underwater. And the impacts that this has had on my relationships don't afford me the opportunity for unbridled joy. And that may come as a disappointment to you, but it is, in fact, the life I'm in.
For a moment, no?
So I think that I wonder if this moment will be experienced when someone, you know, a head of a country comes on a national stage and says, we've achieved herd immunity. Moment when there's like party in the streets. But without that, I mean, what's still happening here is there's an awful lot of, I think people don't want to feel this way, but there's an awful lot of vaccine envy. And because it is so differently distributed by state here and even by municipal area, we're not all together in this, in that sense. Like, there are people who are over 50 that can't get vaccinated in half of the states, while the other half of the states, people over 50 can, and other states have opened it to everybody. And that is a weird thing for us to experience. As much as we know that we are the United States and that the federal government is something that's largely viewed with skepticism, and that for the history of our country, we've felt, our leaders have felt, that deliberation decision-making should happen locally because it's better locally than it is imposed at large. But that leaves us in a weird position here where we're very much experiencing the effects of local administration, and they're not good for us. So to have a collective moment, it's a little bit of a category problem we're having.
Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin' Birds, a book and free webcomic by our friend Aaron Reynolds. And guess what, guys? It's not just a book. It's not just a free webcomic. It is also playing cards. That's right, playing cards. So what I'm going to do right now is I got these playing cards from Aaron, and I'm going to go in here and I'm going to see what I got. Okay. Well, I got Joker. I got the Joker. And it's not a bird. It's an octopus. And underneath it, I read, well, this is fucking awkward. This is some good stuff. Honestly, this is an amazing gift. I recommend you go to effinbirds.com, EFFINbirds.com. Get the book, get the playing cards, and follow them on social media. It'll brighten up your day. And thank you. Thank you to Effin' Birds for supporting Soft Revolution.
And you know what, Ali? I think it's funny because I agree. We haven't had that moment. But I think those moments that you're talking about are only ever brought on, really, by getting together.
Yeah, that's true.
By a concert, yeah. By a parade, by a collective gathering of celebration. That is, that we all decide on this date, at this time, we're going to get together and celebrate. And so when will that moment come? I think that moment will come at a concert, or at when art is allowed to influence a huge number of people at the same time again. Yeah. I think that's when you'll start to see that kind of catharsis. But I also agree, Jen, that it's like, you know, it's funny because in many ways, like the analogy between a war and this, there are analogies. But on another level, there isn't going to be a peace treaty signed, at which point everyone will pack all their stuff up and go home. This thing's going to trickle away. It's going to flare up and be terrible in one place and be barely... somebody just sent me this morning on Twitter some camera footage of her at a concert in New Zealand, you guys. It's devastating. It's 30,000 people at a concert.
Right.
With their phones up in the air, partying their faces off. And she's like, we're leaving the lights on here. But when I looked at it, I was like, how are we ever getting back there? How are we ever going to do that? And I think that, I have to believe we will. But when that happens is when that moment of catharsis will come for all of us. And, you know, it goes back to what we say over and over again. It's like, if you don't have art and you don't have culture and you don't have moments of cultural shared narrative, then what you have is a society with no common story and no common love and no common moment of celebration. And that's where we're at right now. We're all at home looking at various factions telling us various truths, choosing sides. And, you know, we talked about this last week, Ali. Like, it's really pissing me off that I have to decide whether I'm with Rand Paul, you know, or whether whether I'm with, like, you know, Eric Feigl-Ding, who is like, you know what I mean? Like, that's not my, I don't want to choose that. Lockdowns, do they work? I don't know. I'm not a statistician. You know what I mean? I don't like them.
No, lockdowns do work.
I know
work.
That.
You can't,
I don't like them.
Lockdowns do work. You can't talk about New Zealand and 30,000 people
I'm
in a concert
and
say like
that. I'm not even going to do this. Because I don't know.
Yes, you do.
Know what
yes,
I know about?
Do.
I'm looking at my records. You want to know what the best B-sides of 1993 were? I can tell you in a heartbeat. But what I do know is, like, I think I share the same emotions about what is happening to us as the vast, as you say, Ali. I think that 90% right now is there. And it's there in people who just want to see their parents, or just want to go out to a bar with their friends, or just want their kids to return to school safely, or just want to have a meal. Like, that is the 90%.
So it won't happen in a moment. Everyone will have their own moments.
No, but Ali, I completely agree with you that I miss Trudeau coming out and talking every day. My mother was just saying this, you know, during the Second World War, Roosevelt and Churchill were on the radio every goddamn day.
Every day, get out there and speak long, because he's the only person that could hold attention for a long period of time. You have the bully pulpit. Only you do. There is only one person in every nation that can do this. And that's why, and I think, you know, I think Trudeau is a great communicator. I think Biden, I love Joe. I don't know. You know, I just feel warm when he comes out there. But I think he needs to, I think we our leaders need to come out and have conversations. I'll tell you one problem that's happening with politics, and I notice it right now. And I think communication is incredibly important, but I think effective communication is important. And right now, what you hear is like, hey, make sure you could get it in 10 seconds. Make sure what you do is 5 seconds. Make sure that this thing is like, you know, don't go over 1 minute. Don't go over 1 minute. But then I'm like, guys, we need to stop this. I, you know, whatever you think of AOC, whatever you think of her politics, this woman did a 90-minute Instagram Live explaining a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. I'm like, that's the kind of energy we need to be bringing in. We need our politicians to be able to like speak that way and to speak in long durations. We can't do it. You cannot explain why the AstraZeneca vaccine had to be halted for blood clots, even though it was, you know, one out of 250,000 or five out of 500,000, which is less than actually what happens in the population in general. You can't do that in a TikTok. There are certain things that can't be TikToked. And, and you know, I just read, just finished reading Bill Gates's How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. This is required reading, guys, that cannot be expressed to people in a TikTok.
I have one of the ways you could do it. I bet it's not in the book. Put Bill Gates in jail.
No. Torque.
Arrest Bill Gates. That's a
and
good
then what,
beginning.
And then put a camera in there?
Oh, you know, you just
seize
just,
the money.
Just get them all, throw them on an island, take their money, and then we can start talking. I'm sick of these people. I'm sick of the billionaire class. I'm sick of their sociopathic need to collect money, influencing every single moment of our daily fucking lives. Bill Gates is a smart guy. I think his intentions around the vaccine are good. I don't believe he's trying to implant
a chip
in us or anything.
He's done some great work on it.
He's done some great work. He should give his money away, all of it.
Every penny.
He should
he's
give every
like over
50% penny away.
Of it away.
And he should stop running a company that creates that much wealth. It should not create that much wealth. It should be redistributed to his workers before he even collects it. This is the issue, man, is that we are now being controlled by oligarchs, by people who just think that personal collection of wealth is once I get all that wealth, then I'll go out and be benevolent. I'll get us to Mars and I'll cure cancer and I'll do all these things. Hey, man, thank you, but we got this. Just give us the money that we gave you back. And then we as a society will solve these problems. When we are in a situation where a billionaire can become the president of the United States, sometimes it's going to be a smart, compassionate, brilliant billionaire. Sometimes it's going to be Donald J. Trump. So, like, I don't want to live in a society where these people have as much control as they have over our public conversation. All that said,
I want to ask Jen quickly.
And I bet book is worth reading.
The book is worth reading. Jen, let me ask you a question. Is it possible to have billionaires, capitalism exist, but for it to be on a bed of empathy and dignity and love? Is it possible for the two to exist?
No.
Why?
Well, capitalism's historical relationship with the slave trade and the transformation of people into products is built into the DNA of how capitalism works.
And capitalism's fundamental founding principle is people are selfish and stupid, and you cannot trust them. You can only trust yourself. So get what you can, make as much as you can, take care of your people, and don't worry about other people. That is what capitalism at its foundation says. Socialism says people are good, and we deserve to have dignity in our lives, and we deserve to go through the experience of being alive together in some way that resembles each other's experience so that we can maintain our empathy and our sense of togetherness. And when you have people tweeting out that, you know, after 2 weeks of quarantining, we flew to a private island and just got away from this, that is like a knife in the heart of societal unity, of societal compassion, and it can't work. The center cannot hold when these people are collecting. Allie, I just read Bernie today. 40% of the income of all the money in the United States is owned by two fucking people. That is insane. It cannot continue. We can't live this way. And I just feel like You know, we've gotten into a very big, broad conversation here.
No, but I'm saying, do we need to tear it all down, or can there be restraints,
yes.
or can there be... Exactly. I just want clarification. Yeah. The reason I say this is because you have, you know, it's interesting. Going into politics has been this really interesting thing, because now I feel like I have every single person in my head, and it's, I feel like it's really important for us to do, because what you're asking for is equity, fairness, justice, and it's something that everybody deserves and wants in this world.
Yeah, and I think it's not going to be easy.
I know, but I want to just make sure that everybody listening here doesn't just get triggered and say, oh, wait,
right.
Torque doesn't want me to make money. Torque doesn't right. want me to have a business. And I think it's important for us to be able to explain clearly to the regular folk what it is we're actually trying to say, or what it is you're actually saying.
Let's talk about the nuance thing, because I just want to move on to Jen. I want you to make your last point, and then we'll move on. Just go ahead.
Yeah, just because to Ali's point, which I think is well made, what I would say is that we have now 50 years of research on the idea that capitalism can rein in people's selfish motives through the use of the correction in the market, that customers will refuse to engage in bad exchanges with. And so I think, you know, clearly this is not supported by evidence. And so we have to come to terms with the fact that the way to rein in selfishness and rein in the enormous accumulation of capital under capitalism is through regulation. And the problem with regulation being our correction mechanism is that powerful people control politics. So they control the imposition of regulations. And so it is not an effective stopgap to make sure that capitalism doesn't leave children hungry, which is what it's doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. And this is, let's move on to the next one, because this is about whether things should be complicated or not, ultimately.
And, is it about Cameo? Are we talking about Cameo or no?
I wanted to do the WAP thing. I wanted to ask you guys about the WAP Candace Owen thing.
Always with the WAP. This podcast, man, we're so WAP-y. It's unbelievable. We'll get to the WAP. But first, I want to talk about a real sort of case study in something that is happening over and over again, and something that people, even within quite strict orthodoxies of political agreement, have disagreements about. And it's this. Alexi McCammond left Teen Vogue. Alexi McCammond is a young African-American journalist. She was recently appointed the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue. Now, you out there, you might think, well, who gives a damn who's editing Teen Vogue? Teen Vogue has actually been one of the most politically radical publications over the last few years in the whole country. They've broke some really important stories, and they've actually written some really important, quite radical ideas into the public conversation. And so this is a very coveted role, to get the editor-in-chief role at Teen Vogue. And she was appointed and then immediately resigned. And the reason for that was that it was found that she had tweeted when she was 17 years old. That's how long Twitter has been around, people. Like, social media is now influencing the lives of people in mid-career, right? So just to give you some perspective on how long we've been wasting our time with that shit. She tweeted when she was 17 years old some tweets that were anti-Asian. I've read them. They were anti-Asian and homophobic. I've read them. They were homophobic. She was 17. Shitty thing to say. I wouldn't have said it when I was 17, in public or in private. But she did. She went through whatever she was going through. Now she's here as a 30-year-old, and she got this gig. And she has been made to resign. Now, by all accounts, Alexi McCammon's a fine journalist. She's a smart person. And when she was appointed, people seemed universally happy about the appointment. Is this okay? Can we do this? Can we have a society where people are never forgiven, and where things that they said that are regretful and stupid and mean and ugly stay with them to the extent that they no longer can operate in the public sphere? And if we can do that, how do we do it? Where does it end? Let's go to you, Jen, first, with your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tricky issue. My first impulse is to say we need some kind of some kind of American version of a truth and reconciliation process that will allow us not only to deal with the problems that we have at a national scale, say gerrymandering as a continued expression of white supremacy, or the problems that we have at an individual scale. So I think that if we even had a roadmap for how to collectively address and then resolve these kinds of issues, it would be a lot easier, because what's happening right now is the court of public opinion, which is, I think, largely populated with people who get rewards for having hot takes on things. We've sort of turned it into this Roman bread and circuses where the public says, you know, go or no go. And this doesn't seem like the way in which we should treat one another. It doesn't seem like a good way to get justice for the people who have been harmed. And it doesn't seem like a good foundation for dealing with conflict.
So what do you think should have happened with Alexi McCammond? I mean, what if you were her boss at Condé Nast and you found out these tweets had happened, what would you have done?
Well, if there wasn't already some sort of internal policy for how to deal with this, the first thing I do is write one. I mean, I think every institution needs to have some, you know, transparent process by which they deal with these things in an HR department. I don't think I would allow it to be public news because I fail to see how that benefits mm-hmm. anybody involved in the situation. And then whatever your internal mandates are, I mean, I'm sort of allergic to the, like, we should just stick them in a 3-day course on implicit racism. I don't see evidence that that kind of stuff transforms people's perceptions or their lives or their treatment of others, but there are better alternatives to that. And I think one of those would be appropriate to deal with internally. I think it's really dangerous that we have a public sphere that is involved in the evaluation of people's moral character in public. I mean, I don't even do that in my interpersonal relationships, judge people for how they act. I confront them when their actions bother me or they disrupt me in some way. But never does that conversation escalate to what kind of person you are, because that who gave me the right to do that?
Ali, you're in the world now of you know, living on your reputation, right? You're going to go and try and get the votes of the public. And that means you have to uphold certain standards that the public decide are worthy. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts about what happened with Alexi McCammond? Does it alarm you?
There is a fact that's really important. I mean, she really only got fired once there was a 7-figure ad buy that was taken out in respect to, you know, her. So we just have to take that into consideration.
Just be a little more exact about that. What do you mean?
So Teen Vogue had a 7-figure advertisement buy from, I forget which company, but it's when they said, listen, we're pulling it because of her. That's when the resignation came. So It looks like Teen Vogue was going to stand by her. There is something else too, you know, she deleted these tweets even before getting this job. This is something that actually isn't the first time that came up. She's apologized for them. She said, you know, it was despicable what I said. It was wrong. It was racist. I'm cognizant of it. And I deeply, deeply apologize for offending everybody. I knew what was wrong. My kind of view is this. I mean, A, she was 17 years old. And B, I will also say that if we are to accept, which is true, that we are in a society that is full of white supremacy, misogyny, systemically, like it's literally there. You can also assume that an individual years ago was around that kind of stuff, and that kind of stuff osmosis in people. You know, we are a tribal society. We are learning that you get people around certain people, whatever, you know, even your kind of crapping on the billionaires, Torque, all of a sudden, you know, it's hopping on me. I'm feeling it. Bill Gates, that book might get returned. I don't know. So it happens. So I go to myself, I empathize with her because I know who she is now. And I've read a lot of her work, both on Axios and prior. And I go, that's not that person. And she was 17. That brain is not fully formed. And I think, you know, Sarah Silverman had this like viral thing. And it's something that you and I talk about all the time. She spoke about righteousness porn, which is going on right now. But and this is something I've said too. It's like, I cannot call myself a progressive if I do not believe in people's ability to progress. And I cannot be a progressive if I don't believe that people cannot live unless they learn. Nobody comes out of the womb knowing everything, particularly in a society full of white supremacy, particularly in a society full of misogyny. No matter how woke I think I am, even in respect to women's issues, even having two older sisters, whatever it was, I'm still in this system. I'm still learning stuff, right? So I don't
it's
know.
Something too that I think is very dangerous for progressivism, because the right doesn't do this to their people. They do not have this kind of vicious orthodoxy in place where if you are found to have made a mistake, you are ex-nayed. It's not how they roll. Now, they go to the other degree. You can be a multi-raping lunatic without a brain in your head who has stolen money from the government and a complete charlatan and criminal. And they're like, as long as you torture immigrants and don't let women have abortions, we love you. But the left is caught in this purity trap. And I think that it is used against us very effectively a lot by the right. That our insistence upon perfection is a weapon that has been turned against us. And I just think it's kind of sad. But when I think that, then I think, holy shit, this is complicated. Because, this week as well, there's a musician called Mike Milosh who has a band called Rye. Rye are good band, really good band. I know Mike a little bit. A few days ago, his ex-wife went on the internet, went on Instagram and said, Mike Milosh has raped me. He groomed me as a minor. He did Whoa. These terrible things to me. He is a terrible person. He is done. His career is over. People are on the internet saying this guy is scum. He very well could be. I don't know. I don't know. I know that is what his ex-wife said. I have no reason not to believe her. But I think that this is really, really powerful stuff. And that we have got to come, as you say, Jen, to some sort of agreements about how these platforms are used, how much our online and offline lives intersect, and how much we should be responsible for what people say about us online. But also, what's the recourse for Mike Milosh? What does he do in the face of that? He can't do anything. He can do what he did, which is say, this is a vicious lie. I stopped giving her money, and so she's coming to ruin my life. Maybe that's true. Maybe it isn't true. I don't know. It's not really my business, is it? And so I just... I personally find myself often confused about this question. And there are times when, like in the case of Alexi McCammon, where I feel like that's a real shame. This seems like a young woman of color who was advancing in journalism. That's exactly what progressivism says we want to see. We want to see more diversity in positions of power. We want to see more perspectives and more faces that don't look like white people, controlling the debate. Then she gets the job. A couple of tweets that are ugly and stupid and racist, boom, she's gone. So that's terrible. But if Mike Milosh did this thing to his wife, I don't know. Do I want Mike Milosh to be able to go out on tour again and abuse young women? No, I don't want that. So I just don't know where it leaves us as a society when there's no stopgap between the initial accusation and societal judgment about it, when there is no middle where we actually look at the situation and say, what's true here? It used to be called the justice system, and now it's justice is just whoever gives you the most retweets wins. It's terrifying, I think.
Yeah, so I think this is not to contravene or contradict anything you just said, but to add another piece to it, which is, which issues from my own experience. So this past month, February, was the first time in my life that I have submitted a sexual harassment claim without the fear that would bounce back on me.
Right.
So although it is not at all the first time that I have been discriminated against on the basis of gender, in fact, there are dozens and dozens of those, including, criminal activity. The fact is that the justice system was not an effective intermediary for me and for many other women. The idea that I could report those crimes and then have them be dealt with responsibly just isn't a fair description of the situation. So the countervailing fact here is that, particularly around gender-based violence, I think that the swell of public reporting is a criticism of the ineffectiveness of the justice system of treating us like citizens.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's the countervailing tension here. It's not at all that I'm endorsing the public adjudicating a criminal case. I agree with you that is inappropriate and we should do whatever we can to disallow that in all cases.
Yeah.
I think we need to have a conversation. I think that we need to have a conversation about, like, okay, this is where we are. This is, you know, the diagnosis and what is the prescription? And I think it's about going forward. What are we going to tell people? I think what I would tell youth and I would tell anybody is that you are entitled to your own opinion, but you are also now realize that you are responsible for its expression. Think before you speak. Think before you speak. You know, we have advanced so much. It's not going away. We have advanced so much as a species, and there are things we can learn, and this is a transferable skill that I think we can apply. So that is something that definitely needs to happen. And then,
but ironically, Ali, you know, these platforms encourage not thinking before you speak.
I know. So it's,
I mean,
up to
literally,
us,
they're called Twitter. You know, that is like, just say whatever bullshit's on your mind and we will keep it in perpetuity and reprint it whenever we choose to. It's insanity.
Well, people have been asking for an edit button on Twitter, and they're like, no, they might be bringing out an undo button. But sometimes we need to allow editing. But I think that's the most important thing. So you have the right to anything. You could say whatever you want, but just recognize now we are all public figures. Every one of us is a public figure now. Before it wasn't the case. You'd say the crazy thing. And also the other thing to think about is, like, look, let's try to treat, there are certain things that are just bonkers. Certain things that, if, you know, what happened with Rye, if that was, that's bonkers, right? But I think it's also important for us to look into our own families and look into our own lives and ask ourselves, the people whom we are closest to, are they or have they been perfect? Have they ever said a kind of, like, ignorant statement? Yeah. Like, what are your Thanksgiving dinners like? What are your Christmas dinners like? I don't know. Please tell me. Because and it's so really important.
My family
for us to
tends to
reserve
its cruelty for each other. You know, we like
I also, you know, I will just say a little quick story. Like, my family obviously came from Iran, and, you know, I came here when I was three. 1986 is when we came. And, you know, to see the level of progressivism in my family and what they have become compared to where they came from, and just their openness in terms of other races, their openness in terms of, you know, LGBTQ2S+, and in respect to all of that, I just go, you know, we are not statues. We are ever flowing rivers, and we have to allow some kind of grace for each other. Because, you know, Torque, one day, even you. No, I'm kidding. No, you're perfect. You're perfect.
No, I mean, I'm someone who constantly says things they regret. But, you know, the only reason I tend to regret things is because I've said something about somebody in power that screws me over. And, you know, to me,
Bill Gates was going to fund your next project, bro.
Well, no, but truly, like, I just yesterday just, like, wrote to the president of Spotify and told him he was a criminal. Like, I just do these things because I think if you're going to punch up. You know, my regrets come from being too honest about things I truly believe, not saying stuff that could hurt somebody below me or with me in society. And that, to me, is why it's always so mysterious when I, you know, as cool as this woman I'm sure is, and as smart as she is, why did she say those things? And how is it possible for someone that smart and a person of color who knows what it means to have bigotry perpetrated against you, how is it possible that she found a way to be bigoted against someone? And that is the real question, is where's the empathy gap? Where are we not filling in the imaginative and empathetic gap for people? And that's brings us to the subject of this podcast and why we all are sitting here, and what we all, I think, share as people is a belief that creative thought, imaginative thought, artistic thought breeds
empathetic.
Empathy. Yeah. Breeds understanding, breeds unity, and it breeds a society where people get what each other are going through. Jem, we're going to let you go, but I think we should end
on what? I want to hear what happened.
On a high note.
Well, so
and that high note is two women putting their vaginas in each other. Is that, what the hell's going on?
What happened with Candace Owens? Like, can you update us? I hate Candace Owens.
I can, and I'll even link it to what you just said. So in terms of the kind of creative response idea, you know, it does surprise me that there is, I haven't heard anyone in public saying, all of you folks who are spending your time giving hot takes on Twitter, thinking that you want to respond to, let's say, and I think it deserves mention today, the murder of 8 people by a man who appears to be mentally ill and also stricken with a very bad case of misogyny and racism, that we feel this righteous desire to respond to such awful stuff, to such hateful stuff.
Yeah.
And in the process, we just sort of produce this this conversation about how bad everybody is online. And my creative suggestion for a response would be to take some of that energy and organize.
Yeah.
Like you have, you're stuck at home behind a computer, virtually anybody in the world is available to you. Instead of taking that 15 minutes to register your complaint online, you know, I promise we know that you are a good person and you think murder is bad and racism is bad. But how about take that same energy and instead of flowing it into sharing that opinion with others, you work on the structures that reproduce it. You get together five of your friends and figure out a way to make something that's in your neighborhood a little bit less racist, a little bit less sexist. I think that's a better creative response to that moment.
And so that brings me to, Jen.
And that brings you
to Candace Owen, who is a, I believe she identifies as an African-American conservative commentator in the news. And she has taken to both the news channels in America and also to Twitter to register her complaints with the song WAP and more generally with music like this that encourages immoral behavior, particularly among young girls. The argument being that something in the song WAP is producing a negative relationship between girls and their bodies or their sexual lives. It is very uncomfortable for me to see a woman of color on television criticizing women of color who are the most successful members of their fields. I think that's just like top line, something that strikes me as remarkable and awkward. And then this notion that, you know, the Republicans and conservatives who have jumped on this line and are using it to talk to their constituents are largely talking about immoral liberal media and in particular cultures. Liberal culture's desire to brainwash our kids into doing things that are immoral. And I am just burning with curiosity about how both of you respond when you're faced with this claim. As artists, how do you talk to people when they describe what you do in this way?
You know, when I see Candace Owen do stuff like that, I'm like, well, you just did Cardi B's job for her. I mean, you know, I don't know how else to say this. Like, all you squares out there, if you keep getting pissed off, we'll keep doing it. You know, that is what pop music is about. That is what youth culture is about. That is what rock and roll is about. I cannot believe there are still people getting offended by musicians wearing no clothes, writhing around. It's so cute. I just think it's so quaint.
Yeah.
It's like, my 11-year-old daughter, I heard her the other day, she's in her room. All she does is sing. She's the first lady of the American Musical Theater. And she's singing like a virgin, right? And I'm listening to her sing like a virgin. I'm like, man, I remember when that song came out, people freaked out. They lost their minds. Now, it's like you literally might hear Like a Virgin played at a wedding of a bunch of Mormons, like totally, nobody would bat an eye, right? No one would blink. So, get offended. That's great. That's what they wanted to do was piss off squares like Candace Owen. They pissed off squares like Candace Owen. People who actually matter to them, namely young people, are excited and turned on or repulsed and think it's gross. But you know what? They have the ability to decide for themselves whether they like something or not. And they are actually autonomous human beings who don't think to themselves, oh, Cardi B, it likes to writhe on stage naked. I too want to. Some of them think that.
I don't want to.
Some of them don't. No. Some of them don't. Some of them just like the tune. So, you know, I love it when the right does this. This is the best thing we can do to them. Offend right-wing people. That is a great way to spend your day. Go out and do something that offends bigoted people. Wear a dress to the store. You know, whatever it is, like, it's so silly and it makes them look so silly.
Yeah.
And, I am in favor of offensive art. Even when it offends me, I'm in favor of it. So I don't know. God bless Candace Owen for doing our job for us. You know,
I don't know. There's so many songs. There's so many songs that now, as an adult, I look back and I'm like, oh my God, that song was about Oh my God, terrible. That was about sex. I had no idea. Terrible. Oh my God, there was this one song I used to love. I love R&B. You know, this song like, let me lick you up and down. Like, I remember being in the car with my Persian mom. She didn't speak English well enough to understand what was going down. But I was just like, yeah. And now I look back, I'm like, holy moly guacamole. What was I listening to? But this is the same stuff they do all the time where, you know, there's a mass shooting and they say it's video games as opposed to gun laws. And it's right. The exact same thing here too. It's just ridiculous. People are able to discern that it's art. When you watch a, you know, crazy movie, you know that what you're listening to is not real. It is made up. And for a right-wing conservative group of people who believe in the agency and the brilliance of the individual, have some faith in us.
Yeah.
Is what I would say.
And not only that, but like, you know, the constant comparison, and I'm sure Candace Owen used the word pornography. Newsflash, pornography is not that. That is an abstraction of sexuality. Those two weren't having sex. Pornography is when you actually have sex on screen. So this is a constant misapprehension that people make about what art is. Art is not the thing itself. Art is an abstraction of the thing itself. And the genius and the beauty of art is that it allows us to deal with difficult things, with sexuality, with abuse, with fear, with death, with murder, with all these terrible things in the context of our imagination instead of in the context of reality. And, you know, if you can't see the difference between that, then you are probably a fan of Candace Owen. But like, it's just, I don't care. I'm not, I don't care that you're offended. It doesn't interest me. Turn the TV off if you're offended. And that goes for the left as well. You know, I don't care if Bill Burr offends you. If Bill Burr offends you, turn off the Grammys. I'm so sick of people getting offended. Just don't look at it. Solution brought. Anyway, you know, let's go. But before we go, I want to hear some art picks. Allie, what's your art pick this week? What should people be doing, listening to, buying, reading?
My favorite movie of all time, Talk to Her by Pedro Almodovar. I saw it again. Yeah. Hable con ella in Spanish. It's one of the most incredible, incredible movies. It's about these two men who form a deep friendship because the two women that they love are both in comas. What an incredible premise for a film. And the music is unbelievable. It's just exquisite. It is, I would say, it won the screenplay for, I think the first time, or one of the first times, a foreign film won the best screenplay Oscar when it came out. And I consider it his best movie. I consider it one of the best movies of all time. Check it out. And there's a moment in there where Caetano Veloso, a very popular Brazilian singer, sings a famous Spanish song, Cucuru Cucu Paloma, which is, it is the most, one of the most beautiful moments in cinema you will ever see. So that Talk to
Is
Her.
Is it streaming, Allie? Where can people find it?
You know what? You can't find it on Netflix. Unfortunately, you have to do a purchase or a rental, but it because it's worth it.
Paying for art alert.
I know. Alert. I hope. Alert. It's worth it's it. Tough. I would honestly, if you're going to decide to rent it, don't buy it because you're going to want to watch it more than once and you're going to want to watch it as years go by over and over again. So that's my pick.
Beautiful. Talk to Her by Pedro Almodovar. Lena, what's your art pick?
I am going to also do two movies, both documentaries, both music documentaries. So,
hey, cool.
Yeah, the first one is the Billie Eilish documentary that's streaming on Apple. And
haven't watched it yet. Is it good?
It is lovely. I think not only because she is a really captivating young person, mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. interesting human being, she but is, also because you see a fair amount of her craft. You see a little bit of her relationship with her brother and how they work together. And she's got some fairly interesting things to say about being protected as a young person in the entertainment industry and how her family helps with that. Yeah. So I think that that's just a fascinating character study. The other one is... Biggie, I've Got a Story.
Oh, yeah.
It's another documentary about Biggie Smalls. And this one has the great advantage of accurately reporting the history involved. And it also is, it's got a lovely set of people who are talking to the camera, people who have interesting perspective on his life. Like, it's not Puff heavy. It's very much heavy on people who knew him before. Mm-hmm. Puff Daddy or whatever he's going by now. Sean Combs got involved. And my God, the music. I mean, one of the things I will be forever grateful for is being born when I was, so that in the course of my life, I was able to see the birth and maturation of rap music. And that period of time when he is ascendant, I mean, it is just beautiful. And
The flow I'll give is you like, the greatest flow of all time. There's no question
I mean, just
about it.
Extraordinary creativity. Yep. And then to pair with that, I will say that the best read I've had recently on rap music from the 80s and 90s, with a particular focus on gangster rap and related subgenres, is Joshua Clover's book, which is titled 1989. And it's a study of music and social change in 1989. It's a little technical because he's very smart, but it is super interesting.
Cool. Great, great picks. I'm going to go check all of those out. My pick is a little pop song. And one of the things that I love most about pop music, and it is one of my favorite experiences, is just seeing somebody mention a song that they like and going and checking it out, and it completely, you just falling completely in love with it. There's a musician called Will Weisenfeld who goes by Baths. It's great. He's a great band. He makes great music. He's from Philadelphia. But he was on Twitter the other day and he said this song by Petey and Maya Folick, which is called Haircut, he loved it. So I clicked on it. And I want you guys to listen to this and know that as someone who has spent their life trying to perfect the idea of what a pop song is and being in love with the idea of a 3-minute pop song and how much it can transcend the mundanity of your life and make you feel special, and how a simple little repetitive pattern of melody can completely open your world, to me, this is one of those songs. It's circular. It's simple. It's about getting a haircut. It's about being lonely. It's about going to parties and talking to people and feeling alone. It's about all those private, simple things about being young that pop music captures and turns around and looks at more gracefully, I would argue, than any other form. And I just cannot stop playing this song. So I hope that you too become infected with Haircut by Petey and Maya Folick. Well, that's Soft Revolution for another week. Jennifer Lena, thank you so much for joining us, buddy. We are so much blessed by your presence.
Such a better show when you're here.
It is.
Thank you all so much. It's really one of the great joys of my life.
And you stay safe in New York City, all right? Watch out for the rats.
Sure will.
The rats are the size of baseballs. Oh, my God, they're huge. Thanks for joining us for one more week. Thank you. We love you. This is Soft Revolution. I'm not afraid to